Hello listeners, producer Ben here, and it's Mental Health Awareness Week this week, so we've teamed up with Calm, who we've been working with all season, to bring you this special bonus episode. It's our pal David Priest talking to his old friend and teammate Tony Coton, goalie for Watford, Man City and Sunderland, and a coach at Man U and Aston Villa. They're going to talk about their respective careers, but also the particular stresses of a life between the sticks, and how Tony sought help after first his playing and then his coaching career was cut short. Calm is the campaign against living miserably, a charity dedicated to preventing male suicide, which is the leading cause of death for men under 45 in the UK. Every day from 5pm till midnight, Calm provide a free, confidential and anonymous helpline and a web chat for any man who needs support. Find out more at thecalmzone.net.
Tony Coton, thanks for joining us today.
Welcome, mate. Good to see you. It's been a long time.
It has. I should explain that we've known each other a long time. We were together at Sunderland.
Yeah, I was responsible for you not kicking on at Sunderland.
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Responsible for me leaving? No.
No. I think the broken leg put paid to that.
Yeah. Both our injuries at Sunderland. You even more so. I mean, I had a lot of injuries at Sunderland, but I mean, yours was a pretty serious one, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it ended my career, but I was player coach and responsible for the goalkeepers, which you were one of them. But unfortunately, 11 games into the season, 5 fractures in a just innocuous challenge at Southampton for Sunderland, ended in 5 fractures and the end of my career, and really the end of my goalkeeping coaching career at Sunderland.
We're discussing your book here, There to Be Shot At, an autobiography, and quite early on in the book you mentioned the mental pressures that are on goalkeepers. Now we speak about injuries there. Now there's a lot of sort of mental battles that go on with footballers when you get injured. You know, how did you deal with that at that time in your career?
I think in general, Precy, it's sport in general. You know, any people that play sport, whether it's amateur, however keen they are, or certainly professional sports people, when they get the injuries, it's how you overcome them. And it gets easier as you get older because you learn to deal with things. When you're younger, you want to play at all times, even when you're not fully fit. And I can vouch for, I've done that, you know, when I was at Birmingham. It wasn't for the money, although my appearance money was bigger than my actual wages. The fact that sometimes you were forced to play through injury, and other times you wanted to play. You know, I can play through that injury. You might not have done yourself justice by playing, but that's the way it was those days. But the mental side of it is very difficult, especially if it's a near career ending one. Fortunate or unfortunate, mine was at the end of my career, my big injury or injuries. But I've seen some talented people, not just in football, lose their careers to injury relatively early. And, you know, that must be hard to take for them, you know, because it's always a case of what might have been for them, you know. And it's those mental sides. Listen, I think they make you a better person when you really deal with it and you know how to deal with it. But it's very hard when you're young, it really is.
And that's the key about it. It's about how you deal with it and either being taught or learning to deal with those situations as well. And you said there, it came at the end of your career. And we've both been through this now because injury sort of curtailed your career a little bit. You still had a long and successful career. But once you come to the end of your career, did you find any difficulty once that stopped?
Yeah, I found some really dark periods. You know, I remember the nurse walking into me at the Friarage, I think the hospital I was, that I got transported back to up in North Allerton. And under the specialist care there of a Dr. Weber, and she walked into me and I was crying my eyes out. I was 36 years of age. You know, I'd had most of my career, but I'd still got another 2 or 3 years left, I felt, and wanted to play till I was 40. And I was crying my eyes out, and she didn't know why I was crying. And it was the fact that I think I knew myself, I hadn't been told that my career was over. So yeah, it's difficult, and you have injuries. You know, you miss periods of your career for maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks with different injuries, but you know they're not career threatening. This one, at the end was I knew deep down when I did it that it'll be a struggle for me to get back. So there were periods where you sort of, a bit of self-pity, a bit of, just being down on yourself. You're not really looking too far ahead. Right, okay, this has happened. If I've got to finish now, I'll do this or I'll do that. You don't think like that because you just want to keep playing. I can only imagine, from my point of view, having it at 36 years of age, of what it must be like when you're a 21 or a 22-year-old. It must be awful.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know that I was probably about the same age when I stopped playing, and I realised that it wasn't just straight away that it hit me. It's kind of, you think, oh, well, I'm still young enough, I can still go on to do other things, I still go to coaching, went into coaching. But then maybe, I don't know, about a year or two later, it just kind of hit me that there was something missing, because it's you're so attached to being a footballer, it's part of who you are.
I think that the biggest part of, certainly a footballer, I don't know about an athlete who's, or a golfer or whatever it is, where it's individual, and they deal with things different. But I've been in a team environment all my life. So from primary school to my secondary school, which secondary school was an all-boys school, and going into football, I've been surrounded by boys, men, laughing and joking, life and soul of the party, Mickey Taker out of me. And I think from that point of view, from missing that day-to-day changing room banter, was the biggest. It wasn't so much the games. I could deal with that. I thought I'd played, over 500 and odd games at the top level. I thought, right, okay, I've done that. It was the day-to-day of getting up and what am I going to do today? And I used to get in early so you could see everybody arriving, what they're wearing, take your mickey out of that, this, that and the other, have a cup of tea with them, what you've been up to. It's suddenly taken away from you, and that's what I found most difficult. I don't know about yourself.
Exactly the same. I think that's sort of an hour and a half before training. I always got in first. Always made sure you say hello to everybody and you speak to everyone. It's the contact with people that you miss. And I've gone from doing that to sort of writing and journalism, where you just it's almost like solitary confinement, you can get cabin fever. Yeah. And you just miss the interaction with people, and it's, I know we all say it's all, we miss the banter, and it is that as well, but it is just chatting to each other and talking about things, and you get things off your chest. You're telling people who you've only known for a year, but because you see them every morning, you open up a little bit more to the person you sit next to and get changed, and people don't see that.
You certainly see, I'm involved in former players associations at the clubs that I've been at. I'm just a member, really. I don't get in organising anything, but I just turn up at all the different functions, golf days or dinners or whatever it is, charity events. And you can tell the ones that went out of football and they've never had anything to do with football. You can tell now. There might have been good lads when they played, this, that and the other. And then whether they turn their back on football or football turn their back on them, you can certainly tell some 30, 40 years later when you meet them, the banter is not there, it's gone, and because it's never been continued, I'm lucky enough now, I'm working at Aston Villa and I try and get into the training ground at least 3 days a week just to get me fix. And that's what it is, a fix and a little bit of humour. Obviously, there's a serious side to it when we're talking the football side of it, but just having the banter, that's it. And for some periods in my life, I never had that. And my wife said I was a completely different person, and I'm a different person now that I'm back in it.
Going on your book as well, close to the end, it's in sort of recent years, you talk about your health problems that you've had with your heart attack. You talk about what happens after the your problems and how you were feeling, how it affected you.
I think I felt a little bit resentful in the wrong way, if there is a right way to be resentful.
What, is it like a why me or...?
Yes, yeah. Exactly that. Because I'd got a brother and sister who wasn't sporty. They never played sport. They, they got the working men's club working 5 nights a week and this, that and the other. And I'm the one that gets a heart attack. and I'm the one that's relatively kept themselves fit, obviously. Been in sport all my life, played sport from the age I could remember. And I get the heart attack. But it was it's an hereditary thing, you know, and I'm touching wood now that nothing happens to my brother or sister, obviously. But I did. I thought, why me? And I went into a dark place. I used to sit watching the TV, not speaking to anyone, one word answers, getting invited to different functions and not telling my wife because I didn't want to go. And it wasn't really until the nurse come to see me, a little bit of aftercare, how you're coping and this, that and the other. And I started, I don't know, being a baby really to her, you know, and moaning and all this. And it wasn't till she pulled down the zip of a uniform, just a little touch. And I thought, all right, first of all, I thought, hey, what's going on here? But
seen this film before.
Yeah. And then she started, it was the top of a scar. And she said, look, you will get over this. I've had open heart surgery and it was many, many years ago and I live a normal life, this, that and the other. But it was like a wake-up call, you know. Alarm went off in my head. I'm thinking, why am I sitting around here moping, sulking, making everybody miserable, making myself miserable? And it was there and then I decided to do something about it. So I did.
And did you go and see someone about that?
Yeah, I went to see therapist or a psychologist, or I just thought I needed to speak to somebody other than family, so I took myself off without anyone knowing. Paid for a few sessions, told them what was on my mind, told them what was really, really, you know, why I was down, and those sessions really, really helped me put life into perspective. Stop being selfish. Stop thinking about yourself. Think about the others around you. And that's what I did. And it really helped. You know, I've just recently been doing some charity stuff for Paul Stewart and David White with the Save charity, which is in light of the Barry Bennell case. And, you know, it's the big message really is for men, no matter macho you are, get out there and talk about it and speak. And you know, this macho thing now is old hat, you know. Just wise up, open your mouth and speak about it and you'll feel a lot better.
Yeah,
you really will.
So you mentioned about the time when you get home, you're in the hospital but you burst out crying.
Yeah, the first time when I had a man cry, if you want to put it that way. No, sorry, it'd be the second time. The first time was when I cried to the champ. Don't cry, champ, as when I'm watching that film. But no, the second time was obviously 36 years of age. This macho guy who had this reputation off the field, this, that and the other.
Did you feel like you had to live up to that reputation?
No, the reputation was given to me by other people. I never earned that reputation. It was right, you know, why let the truth get in the way of a good story, so to speak.
Well, that was it.
There was only a couple of off-the-field things, but...
It wasn't the man I knew.
So, yeah, cheers. No, so it was at the moment when I knew deep down that I think my career was over. The first had the cry in the hospital bed. And then the nurse come in and caught me and tried to blame it on the pain. It wasn't the pain, it was the pain of knowing that my career was over.
So what are you thinking? Are you thinking, you know, sort of like mourning your career, or are you thinking, well, what am I going to do now?
No, yeah, it was just that I wanted to keep playing and I didn't want it to end that way. I wanted to retire on my terms, again, selfishly, but... I wanted to bow out when I wanted to bow out, not because of injury. So there's a lot of factors. I was away, you know, my wife was, and she's not our youngest now, but she was at the time, was just a year old. They were back in Bolton. We hadn't moved into our house in the North East. We'd signed for it. So I got all that to come. But I knew deep down, I didn't think I was going to get back from. I could just tell the way the surgeon was speaking to me. So I slipped into a little bit of a dark place in hospital, and then went, certainly did when they told me my career was over. As I say, we moved into that house, and I'm thinking, why have we moved in when I know I'm not going to be playing again? Didn't know the way the coaching was going to go after it. So I think that was the first real point. I then have to finish my coaching career. So then I went into the coaching career after my playing career finished. I went into the coaching career. Then I had to finish my coaching career.
This is Manchester United.
Yeah. So I'm at Man United. It's the only place to be in football. I can't speak for Real Madrid or Barcelona or anything like that, but certainly in this country, Man United is the only place to be. It's the biggest, it's the best. Fastly being caught up by Man City, I must say. But at the time, we were winning leagues on a regular basis, cups on a regular basis. I'd never tasted so much champagne in all my life. We had the treble, we won the treble. We were all over Europe, all over the world in World Club Championships, tours, private planes, seven-star hotels. Every day was like Christmas Day. You'd come into training and there was another gift for you, or the club sponsors. There's another boss suit, Hugo Boss suit. Unbelievable. So when I collapsed in training on that Friday morning, I knew my knee had been playing up for years. And I thought it was a serious one. And then when I woke up after the operation, to see Sir Alex there, the club doctor, the physio and the surgeon, advised me that, you know, if you want to end up in a wheelchair, carry on doing what you're doing. They gave me a little bit of time. Again, I slipped into that dark hole, self-pity again, feeling sorry for myself, not thinking of where I want to go, what I want to do, not even any plans whatsoever other than I wanted to continue, and how could I continue? But again, I was told that the surgeon said, there's no way you can continue with a knee like that. You'll be in a wheelchair.
You know, you said,
for sure.
When we were playing, well, sort of when you were playing, you're younger, and even at Sunderland, you know, there's still a bit of a drinking culture there. Or did you lean on that at all when you were, after you finished?
No, not really. I think the period I did when I broke my leg at Sunderland, because I lived one side of Sedgefield, and Quinny was doing his, Niall Quinn, yeah, who's a very close mate, as you know, had done his cruciate ligaments, living the other side of the, we used to meet in Sedgefield in the farmers' pubs, and especially on a Thursday, he got back and had a good end to his career. Mm. I was finished. Yeah, and then obviously I piled on the pounds and this, that, and the other, and I thought, saw myself in the mirror and thought, got to do something about this. So, yeah, I didn't know I was really doing that. It's just you're stuck at home all day and there's so much daytime TV you can watch and this, that, and the other, when I just couldn't wait for a Thursday to meet Gwenny for a pint. Yeah. Anyway, so then it all happened. I got them. Man United, and then I collapse, and I'm told that my coaching career's over. And I just didn't know what I was going to do. And to be fair to Sir Alex, he said, look, take a little bit of time, come and see me. He said, I'll put you on the scouting team and you can do some scouting for us and all this. And I thought, I made the biggest mistake of my life. I made a decision when my head wasn't clear, and you should never ever do that. I didn't know what I wanted, but I just suddenly said, I've done it since I was 16. I'm going to have a bit of time out now and I'm going to find myself and do whatever. But in all honesty, it was the worst decision of my life to walk and turn me back on Man United, because I then sort of come away from Man United, and obviously the longer you're away from somewhere, you tend to get forgot. Which I did really, and then I was getting invited back to things, and I thought I wasn't part of it. Forget the 11 years I was there, I just felt I hadn't belonged there.
Yeah.
It was a really strange feeling. I got invited back to a few cup finals. And I just turned them down. I just didn't want to go because I felt I weren't part of Man United anymore. And I didn't want to be seen as hanging on to it. So that was after the worst decision of turning my back on it. I then had a period of like where I did a bit of agency work. I didn't like it. I did some scouting work. And then all of a sudden I got an opportunity to go over to the Middle East. I went over to Dubai to set up a coaching structure, really, from grassroots for a professional team. And it was just what I needed at the time. I felt myself being more unhappy every day. On a daily basis, it was getting worse and worse because I hadn't had that interaction. I hadn't had that banter. So this job offer come out of the blue. I went over to Dubai, met the guy who was working for the Crown Prince, and this was a professional team, and I was to go and set up a coaching structure from grassroots. As it happened, they hadn't got a first team manager. We get into pre-season and I got led with the task of taking the team to Austria on pre-season tour. I told them, look, I'd had 2 days training. I couldn't tell who was the best players, who was the worst players, who played where or whatever after 2 days. And forget it was pre-season, so the fitness side of it has to come into it. I had an English fitness guy called John Phillips and a Prozone guy called Chris Loxton, both English. Chris had come from a table tennis background, no football experience, and John had been working in Malmo in Sweden as a fitness coach. So the three of us just sat down in Austria and said, right, I've got to give you a training programme. We devised this training programme. What I didn't know was that 45 players turned up for this pre-season in Austria. And wow, did it open my eyes. And did we have to think on our feet? Oh, and Fabio Cannavaro had joined us. World Cup legend. So put even more pressure on us because we got to be sure that we know what we're on about. So at that time, that period, and then sort of 10 days later, David O'Leary and Roy Aitken walked through the door and I said, right, all yours. And then in that short period of time, which was a real pat on the back for me, I must have done something right because the players insisted that I stayed with the team. And I never ever got to do what I was meant to do when I was over there. I stayed with the first team. And I said, look, I can't kick a ball, my knee's that bad, that's why I retired. And they got me a retired goalkeeper to come in every day for training and did all my serving for me. And then I insisted that we got 5 goalkeepers in each session so they could all serve each other, and we dealt with it that way. The heat helped, obviously, with the aches and pains. And it was a lovely part of the world to live in and a great experience. So that ended. I come back, and 10 days after I come back, I suffered a heart attack. I'd had various periods in my life where things hadn't gone right. I lost my mum when I was 21, and then my playing career had finished. Then my coaching career had finished, and then I suffered a heart attack. And I think that was like the final blow and the worst that I ever felt after that. In terms of going into a dark place. And when they say you never want to get up in the morning, I never wanted to get up. I never had a shower. I sat in my bathrobe all day. The telly was on, but I couldn't tell you what I was watching. And I never, ever got to the stage where I thought I'd be better off out of here. I never, ever got to that stage. It crossed my mind, but probably I wasn't brave enough or whatever, but I never ever got to that stage where I thought I need to put everybody out of the misery here because I'm just a miserable so-and-so. That was the lowest I'd ever been. And when they say you never want to get out of bed, I never. And my wife, and it was putting real strain on my marriage. It really was. And I've apologised a million times to her for that period of our marriage, of what it must have done to her. And to be unkept, not to have a shave, not to have a shower, and I didn't want to eat. She prepared meals. I'd say yeah, and then I wouldn't want to eat. So I was really, really down. As I say, it wasn't until the nurse come in, told me what she'd been through, and I thought, because you think you're probably one of a handful of people that have a heart attack and have stents fitted, the amount of people that I spoke to that are walking around now having exactly the same procedure, is there's millions.
That's it. That's the advice, is to speak to people who so have been through that.
You never know. If you don't keep, if you keep it all in, how would people know, oh yeah, I had them, blah, blah, blah. Oh, 15 years ago, never felt better.
Yeah.
It's them type of conversation you have and you go, really?
It takes you that. Know? It takes that you wondering about, will I be all right, into thinking, yeah, we'll be all right, he's all right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, she was okay. She showed me the scar from open heart surgery. You know, and then when you open up and you tell people, I think it was the fact that the local Manchester Evening News had done a piece and said he's recovering well, he's had stents fitted. The amount of messages I've got, you know, and it was just I can't echo it enough, because there's always somebody that's been through the same or is suffering the same, and you can help each other.
Go back to the start of your career, and when you first start, and you're talking about not just the pressures of young footballers, but particularly on goalkeepers, it seems to be sort of prevalent, that the pressure that's put on you in that position, just the nature of the job. Do you think that you could have benefited back then from, you know, somebody to talk to or somebody?
I speak about it pre-seed quite a lot at, you know, if I'm asked to go and do any, well, I don't do coaching now, but I'll go and have chats and this, that and the other. And I was abroad at the weekend working, and I actually met the goalkeeper of one of the teams that was playing, and he's only a young goalkeeper, and they got beat, and he was down and this, that and the other. So I chatted to him. I think I helped him about mistakes, that you're going to make lots of mistakes in your career, this, that and the other. I think from my point of view, would I have been better? I think yes, I would have been better. I'd have lived my career completely different. I would. At the time when I was playing, it was a culture that you all went out and had a beer together. And if it still was when we
played together. Yeah.
If you didn't, you know, you were a wuss, and you know, you weren't part of the team. You know, and you never had the team spirit and all that. So you did that. You ate fish and chips. You had pie and chips on coming home after a game. Stuff like that. So the dietary side of it was completely different to what it is now. But I think the technology in the game, the analysts and all that, we never had anything like that. I don't think I was ever in my career ever shown a mistake, a great save, anything that you did well or that you didn't just do so well with, because we never had the facilities to do that. I think now, just little technical things, you know, you could have been a yard further forward there, or, you know, you weren't far enough across, or look at your hand shape there, because when I was a coach, I used to break it down. I used to have cameras out on the training ground. Look what you're doing there. Look what you're doing when you're in the game. That's when you did this, and so much available for you these days. I think the whole spectrum of my game or goalkeeping, from my point of view, I think I would have been a better goalkeeper. I really would. Facilities wise, I mean, the training grounds now, the pitches, there's no mud on them, nothing, is there?
You don't get dirty.
You can come off after 90 minutes as clean as you started. You know, so the facilities. I was at Man City 90 to 96. We never had a gym. Man City never had a gym. You couldn't do any weights anyway.
Probably got more gyms than players at the moment now.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So that's what you were dealing with at that time. No canteens, no eat the right stuff, no dietitians, nothing. So, yeah, I think it goes without saying that anybody that was in my era that's playing today, yourself included, would have been far better than what they were.
And from sort of like the mental health point of view as well, you know, the pressures that young players are under, people probably a bit more understanding now. If you went to a coach and sort of said you had a problem or you had a deal problem maybe back then. Do you think back then?
It all goes under the same umbrella, Preecy, of macho. It's the same thing. It wasn't seen to be. Look at these players now, David White and Paul Stewart and all that. The things that they've hidden, you know, and live with. It's unbearable to think about it, you know. So just because you might have been having a problem with a girlfriend or your mum and dad were splitting up or other off-the-field things that affected you, why you're not sleeping properly, you know, you kept it all in, didn't you? You never went to a coach because you didn't want to be seen as a sissy, so to speak. You know, it's that macho thing where you kept it all to yourself and you had to deal with it yourself and you had to come through it. The morning after my mum died, I went into training. You know, now I think they give you a fortnight off.
And rightly so.
Yeah, to, you know, so you can have your bereave on your, you know, with the rest of your family. I went into training because I thought, I'll get dropped or, you know, I'm missing training or, you know, I was useless in training, but that's what you did. And, you know, I'd left my dad on his own, you know, and he needed somebody. So that was the nature of that macho, hide everything and deal with it, so to speak, wasn't it? And I go back to everything now. It's not now. And what do they say? A problem shared is a problem halved. So I can only say, again, the message is open up, talk about it. Don't keep pushing it away.
That's it. And I think a lot of managers didn't understand. You know, you say that it might see it as a sign of weakness or that, you know, they've put doubts about, into the head about you, but they don't realise that if you can solve that problem, if you can help them, then you'll get an even better player on your hands.
I mean, without doubt, I think the support network now, certainly in Premiership clubs, and certainly at our club at Aston Villa, the support network there's nothing that a player can't get help with anything. You know, it's there. I remember Graham Taylor once saying that he was first and foremost a manager, he was a coach, he was a marriage guidance counsellor, he was a bank manager, he was a second-hand car dealer, because he sorted everything out for the players at Watford, you know, because problems have gone on for players for many, many, many years, and they're still going on. But now they employ people in those various roles to deal with that, you know. Man City will have the financial guy ready for the young kids. They'll have the car guy ready to sort the cars out and the insurances and this, that and the other. And again, most clubs have a club chaplain these days. You know, if somebody's a believer, they'll go and speak to them. It might be off the field things. It might be that they're not playing very well and I need a few prayers to be said.
Exactly, yeah. When I was at Barnsley, sort of last few years of my career, there's a guy there, Pete Amos, who's the chaplain there, and it was always strange that you could walk past him in the corridor and sort of seem happy and say hello to him, have a 5 minutes, and then he'd come back to you about 5 minutes and say, do you want to go and have 5 minutes in the away team dressing room?
He
just knew something was up, and like I said, not there was a few of the lads that had like little sort of like a religious group, sort of like a little church group that they go together. But also there was lots of other lads who just all they did went for 5 minutes chat every week, and it was so much help, so much help.
Yeah. Well, I know Man United. I think I don't know whether John Boyers has retired now, but he was at Watford when I was at Watford, and then bumped into him again, obviously, when I went to Man United. He'd moved from Watford to Man United, and you know, in the early stages when I got into a couple of brushes with the law, went to court, he was there for me. Said a little prayer outside before we went in. It must have helped, not with a fine but with a sentence. You know, they're the support networks that players have now. There's no excuses for them. There isn't.
Obviously, we're doing this for karma because it's an important message to get across, and it's like you said about the situation about you know, sometimes you don't feel like doing anything. You know, you get in a type of way of thinking where you just want to sit there. You don't let anybody bother you when it's kind of what you need. You just need that little bit of contact and to get in touch with someone.
I think listen, it's having the right person to speak to. And this is what it does. It can put you in touch with the right person to speak to from whatever walk of life you're in. You know, we're not just talking about footballers or sports people. We all go through various upheavals or tragedies or whatever it is in our lives. It's just knowing who to turn to and who to speak to. And I can only vouch for myself. It was a blessing for me that I had people to speak to. It really was. It really helped me.
This bonus episode of the Totally Football Show was made possible by Calm, the campaign against living miserably, a charity dedicated to preventing male suicide in the UK. You can find Calm at thecalmzone.net. And please, don't keep your problems to yourself.